You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-fits-all branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear that unites your team in comfort and style. It's why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. From logo polos to fully customized branded wardrobes, our world-class outfitters will partner with you to help your team feel confident on the job and put your brand into action, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters should be your branded apparel partner. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20. Code POD20 for 20% off your first product.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Sky, watch every single live Premier League game on Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Welcome along to the Football Show here on Off the Ball. Coming up in around half an hour's time, we'll be talking to Tim Vickery about the week in South American qualifying even. It's a week where Argentina booked their place at next year's World Cup in Qatar after a stormy enough derby with Brazil. We'll also be talking about Sergio Aguero potentially having to retire from the game and Dani Alves returning to Europe with Barcelona at the ripe old age of 38. We're also looking forward to the return of the Premier League this weekend, including the big game on Saturday night, Liverpool against Arsenal. Remarkably, Arsenal, for all their troubles early in the season, are now on the longest unbeaten streak in the Premier League. They've been unbeaten in their last eight, winning six and drawing two. Delighted to say we're joined by former Arsenal midfielder, now broadcaster and probably known to many of our younger listeners as a voice of FIFA 22, Stuart Robson. Stuart, how are you getting on?
Very good, thank you. And you?
Yeah, good. It's nice to talk about Arsenal in a positive slant. You know, the last few years, particularly since the end of the Wenger era, in many cases it's been talking about Arsenal in crisis. But over the last couple of months, really since the international window at the start of September, there's been a big upturn in Arsenal's form.
There certainly has. They're playing with more confidence at the moment. They're defending better all over the pitch. They've got some pace in the front areas. I think he's come to the right system in terms of playing Aubameyang up front and Lacazette in behind. Then they've got Saka one side and Smith Rowe on the other side. And those players are great counter-attacking players. And I think it's worked for Arsenal. I still think they have a problem in that central midfield area, and they could have a problem against Liverpool. But Arsenal are playing so much better. And I think the right back that's come in has done an exceptional job. I saw him last season playing in Serie A. And he's done a really good job at right back. Good defensively, and he'll also get forward.
Given those changes that have been made by Mikel Arteta over the last couple of months, was it just a case of persevering and having a bit of patience with the way he's trying to change this style and the way that Arsenal are going to play? Or what's the reason for the difference that we've seen?
I hope I'm wrong, but I think he's just stumbled across a formation and a system and a set of players that has worked for him. Because we've had little spells at Arsenal where they've looked a good side. When they won the FA Cup, you thought, well, this is the way they're going to go. They were playing three at the back at the time. There was great movement between the left-sided front player and the left-sided the left wing back. We saw good rotation in midfield, and we thought this was the making of Arsenal. And then when it started to go wrong after two or three games, he changed the system, changed the personnel. And that's what young managers quite often do. When they have a couple of poor results, they look for something else. They want to have a quick remedy. Sometimes it's sticking with what you've got and making yourself better at that thing. And hopefully that's what Arteta will do over the coming weeks. Even if they get a poor result over the next two or three weeks, he sticks with what they've done over the last 8 weeks.
Yeah, because look, it's an intimidating game to play against a Liverpool team who are so good, particularly so good at Anfield again after the kind of miserable run they had the side of the end of the last calendar year. They're back being really difficult to beat at home again, and the return of crowds probably has a lot to do with that too. But for Arsenal, like some of the young guns coming through, we saw Emile Smith Rowe get some caps internationally during this window just gone by. Bukayo Saka seems to have gone from strength to strength. That's probably the excitement at the Emirates currently, that there are these players now coming through at the club.
Well, they're the two players that are exciting everybody, because Saka had a great season last year, had the World Cup where he started in the England team and then got left out and obviously missed the penalty, which was a sad thing for him. But he's come back stronger this season. And Smith Rowe, we saw him two or three years ago playing in Europa League matches, and he was outstanding. And you can have passing football. Passing football will get you a lot of reward if you do it very well. But you also need players that can run with the ball, that can break into space, that can counter-attack at pace with the ball. And that's what Smith Rowe gives Arsenal. That's what Saka gives Arsenal. And Pepe, for all his attributes, wasn't really giving that to Arsenal when he wasn't playing at his best.
Yeah, and it's probably about finding that bit of grit around the centre midfield. You said at the outset, that's probably the one question mark over the team currently. And a lot of players have been trialled in the centre midfield. But Thomas Partey, how important has he become now?
He's an important player. I saw a lot of him at Atletico Madrid, where he looked as though he was a top-class player. He could defend well. He's courageous. He's aggressive at times. He can also play. And that's what you want as a central midfield player. They have to be athletic these days. You can't just be a good passer of the ball, or you can't just be a good defensive player. Yeah, I think you have to have all the attributes. And Partey has got most of the attributes needed to be a top-class player. Who plays alongside him? That's the difficult question for Arteta.
Yeah, a goalkeeper position too, with Ramsdale coming in. Like, eyebrows kind of went up a little bit. You know, Emiliano Martinez, who was a very good player, went to Aston Villa and has flourished. Bernd Leno was then installed as the number one. And then Arsenal went out and bought Ramsdale, who, you know, gone out and had a difficult season last year. But some of his performances since he's come in so far, particularly that Leicester City game, was a remarkable performance from him.
Outstanding. He looks a top-class goalkeeper at the moment. Since he's been at Arsenal, I don't think he's made too many errors. He's made some fantastic saves. He looks very confident. And I think that's been transmitted to the centre-backs as well. Suddenly, Gabriel and White look a decent combination. That wasn't the case at the beginning of the season. And I say the right-back has done well since he's been in. And it's a case of who plays at left-back as well. Both players have done very well. Tierney has done a great job going forward and bursting forward, even when Arsenal weren't playing well. And so is the player that's coming to replace him at times.
Yeah, White built his reputation with Brighton and Hove Albion, and look, he looked a very impressive player before Arsenal signed him. Not ideal the way his season started, and he was out for a while and then coming into the side. He seems to have found his feet, though, in recent games.
Yes, I mean, when you pay that sort of money for a centre-back and you look at the other centre-backs Arsenal had, he's got to be the leader. He's got to come to the fore straight away. You can't sort of say, well, in 2 or 3 years' time, he'll be a good player. He has to come and play well for Arsenal now. He has to be the leader. He has to be dominant. He has to be good in the air. He has to be a strong tackler. And he also needs to be good on the ball. I think he's got a couple of those attributes. I would still question whether physically he's been strong enough, particularly at the start of the season. I think he's a good player. He should get better, but he needs to be a dominant centre-half at the moment.
Arsenal have been okay on the road, Stuart, with the way they've played, particularly with clean sheets, which they've kept. 6 clean sheets kept in their last 9 games away from home in the Premier League. I appreciate that, you know, Liverpool is probably a step up on some of the teams that they've played recently. But that kind of defensive solidity will be really required if they're to get a result against Liverpool.
Yeah, and it depends, again, what Arsenal turn up. We say how well they've played over the last 8 weeks. I was at the game against Crystal Palace, where they were totally outplayed by Crystal Palace, who passed round them. It was far too easy for Crystal Palace to play. Arsenal can't have a performance like that, although they got a draw in the end. If they're that loose, if they're that spread out, Liverpool will punish them. So Arteta's got to make sure the defending's good all over the pitch. But he's also got to look back at Liverpool's game against Brighton and not make the same mistakes. Brighton tried to play out from the back early on, kept having the ball taken off them. Liverpool went 2 up and looked as though they were going to destroy Brighton. But once Brighton played beyond that pressure and they got it into their place just behind Liverpool's midfield, they could have gone on and won the game. It was an excellent performance. And Arteta's got to get the right formation and the right tactics to break down Liverpool.
Yeah, and you got to go with a bit of invention when you go to Anfield. Saw Crystal Palace create plenty of chances and unlucky not to take something out of their game at Anfield not that long ago, and the Brighton game particularly. In that second half, they went out with a positive approach even after they went behind in the game. That's something Arsenal will have to carry on the counter-attack. There's going to have to be, you know, something that's going to trouble Liverpool if they're going to have any chance of taking something from the game, because we've seen Liverpool dominate sides so far this year. They've looked not too far off their 2019-2020 level again.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The question mark for Arteta will be Saka and Smith Rowe. What does he tell them defensively? Does he want them going all the way back with Alexander-Arnold? Does he want him going all the way back with Robertson? Or do they play in a half cheating position, so that when Arsenal win the ball back, they're in space so they can counter-attack quickly? That's what they've done very well this season. I think it's got to be a bit of both. Early on in the game, they're going to have to do the defensive side of the game, but they've got to switch on. As soon as Arsenal win the ball back, they've got to get themselves into positions where they're ready to counter-attack, and they've got to be the first option for midfield players or defenders winning the ball. And if those two players get on the ball with space in front of them, we've seen that Liverpool, in those Brighton games, in that Crystal Palace game, they aren't quite so good defensively. Their good defensive play comes from their pressing from the front, their pressing in midfield, And remember, I don't think they're going to have two or three of their best midfield players playing Liverpool.
Yeah, and that's an area where they can be definitely got it. And that's been the case over the last year or so, where they've had multiple midfield players out and their defensive players around about this time of the year as well. The point in Trent Alexander-Arnold is an interesting one, Stuart, given he offers so much to Liverpool overlapping on that right-hand side, and he's been a chance-creating machine in the opposition half this year. But sometimes teams know that if Salah and Trent Alexander-Arnold are pushed up high, Liverpool can be vulnerable down that right-hand side. It's not an individual fault issue, but clearly there is space when those two players go forward at the same time.
Absolutely. And I think that that's where Aubameyang, if he's fit to play, that's where he comes in, because it may be that Saka, whoever plays out on the left-hand side, Smith Rowe, will have to go back with Alexander-Arnold and stop him crossing the ball. But then Aubameyang, from his centre-forward position, can then go that little bit wider, again, to use that space that Alexander-Arnold has left, and then get down the side of the right side in centre-back, whoever that may be for Liverpool. So Aubameyang's got to play the game wisely, and I think he does well come in from that inside left position, just as Thierry Henry did all those years ago for Arsenal.
That's been the key for Arsenal from an attacking point of view, is getting these best attacking players all onto the pitch at the same time. And that was a bit of a conundrum for Arteta to work out, because there was a brief period where you kind of had Lacazette playing slightly behind Aubameyang and he was about stretching the play, and then Aubameyang goes slightly over and has maybe found a new lease of life playing over from the left-hand side, almost in what I would probably call the Thierry Henry position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I just wonder about what's been going on at Arsenal for the last year or so with Arteta, because it looked as though Lacazette was out of favour and looked as though he was going to leave the club. It looked as though Aubameyang was unhappy playing on the left wing, and then he went to centre forward, and then he was left out the team. And it looked as though some of these players were going to be let go, and suddenly they've come to the fore for whatever reason, whether the tactics are right, whether Arteta's now man-managing them better, whether the players have got together and said, come on, let's give it a good go. You know, we're here for a couple of years. We've got to make the best of it, like Aubameyang and Lacazette. And suddenly they look like players full of confidence. They look half a yard quicker, both in their feet and in their brain. And Arsenal look a good side at the moment. But this is going to be a massive game for both clubs, I think, because if Liverpool lose, and Arsenal win, Arsenal go above them, and Liverpool are out the top four. So it seems a long way away from Chelsea. And if Arsenal lose, everybody will say, well, there we are. Arsenal aren't that great. So massive game for both teams.
Yeah, definitely. And like for Liverpool this year, Stuart, how impressed have you been with Mo Salah? Like Jurgen Klopp, who even tries to spread the praise around, even a few times this year he's been asked, is Mo Salah the best player in the world right now? And he said, yes. Like Salah has put in some incredible performances in this first couple of months of the season.
Absolutely. This is the best that Mo Salah's played. I mean, he's been a great player for Liverpool over the last 3 years or so. He looks as though he can score goals. He looks sharp again. He looks bright. He looks determined. His movement off the ball is fantastic. And it's going to be a tough job for Arsenal to contain him. And it's so difficult to contain because he doesn't play on the right wing. He plays somewhere in between the right wing and the right-sided centre-forward. So there's always that balance. Who picks him up? A centre-half that comes out and deals with him? A full-back, does he stay and follow his runs? That's what's so clever about Liverpool and their front three, the movement of those front three. Very difficult for a back four to pick them up at times.
Yeah, it's a different challenge when it's Diogo Jota playing as opposed to Roberto Firmino. They've been unlucky, Liverpool, with the injuries to Firmino so far this year. But it would seem that the nucleus of that front three are now coming back to form. Like Mo Salah has been so good, Mane on the other side. He's fluffed a few chances this season, but he gets into such good positions that generally he will find himself in a position to score a goal at some point during the game.
And a lot of it comes down, not just to those three players, it all comes down to Liverpool's midfield players winning the ball back. And when they're playing at home in front of a fervent crowd, I think they get away with a lot of, what I would say, dubious tackles that are allowed to go on, and Liverpool win the ball back. And as soon as they win the ball back, then you see Mane making his forward run, you see Salah making his forward run, and Jota when he's playing. And I think there's talk that Mane might not be fit to play. He got a slight injury while he was away. So it could be that Jota plays on the left-hand side and Firmino plays through the middle.
It'll be intriguing to see what the team lineup is like at around about 4:30 on Saturday afternoon. I mentioned at the outset, Stuart, for a lot of younger listeners and those who play FIFA, your voice will now become very synonymous listening to yourself and Derek Gray doing the commentary. Have you enjoyed probably the bit of extra attention or maybe new fans that you've possibly picked up by being a voice of FIFA 22?
I've got to say, I know nothing about what anybody's saying. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on social media. I've got a son who plays it, but he's not going to give me any praise, and he knows me already. So it hasn't changed my world one little bit at the moment. I'm sure it will at some point, but at the moment, I don't know anybody that plays it, so apart from my son, so it hasn't really changed me.
Well, he's probably the toughest audience of all. He'll probably give you more truth than people who'd be on social media.
And he's not a youngster. He's 33, I think, now.
FIFA 22 available to all ages, of course. Like, we were kind of chatting in the office earlier about what the process must be like. Do you just go into a sound booth on your own and just reel off 100 lines in an afternoon for them?
Let me tell you, it's the toughest thing that I have ever done in terms of the media. I wrote most of the lines myself, so that there's hundreds and hundreds of scripts or scenarios that I have to write the words to. And then I would go in and do a five-hour session. I did 41 five-hour sessions in a studio by myself and with a sound technician somewhere else in the world and a producer somewhere else in the world. So it was quite a performance to do it.
Yeah, and a performance is what it is, because it's very difficult to recreate that match feeling when you're not actually sitting on a broadcast getting ready for a game. That's you having to give that kind of energy that you would give to a match experience while sitting in a sound booth.
Yeah. And what you have to realise is I'm not allowed to talk about any team, so I'm doing everything sort of, general,
yep.
generic. I can't see any action. I'm just four blank walls and a microphone. So, I'm just having to put the energy in and trying to get the right tone, which is not easy. Hopefully I did an okay job.
Yeah, I think they've done a remarkable job. You and Derek flow entirely when you listen to the commentary on the game. And Stuart, thanks a million for joining us this evening on Off the Ball. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking to Tim Vickery about South American football.
The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
For me, footwork has been something that's got me out of trouble on more than one occasion on and off the pitch, so I'll go with that one.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
Well, Erling Haaland won't be going to the World Cup in Qatar next year. Still to be seen if Cristiano Ronaldo will be able to book his place. And Italy will also have to come through the playoffs if they're to play in the World Cup next year. But we know that Leo Messi will be going to Qatar in 2022. Argentina qualifying for the World Cup finals. The current South American champions with a draw against their great rivals Brazil during the week. Delighted to say we're joined by our man in Brazil, Tim Vickery. Tim, how are you getting on?
I'm very well. I'm still recovering from the marathon that is South America's World Cup qualification campaign. We've had 8 rounds over the last 2 months, 3 in September, 3 in October, and 2 just now. So at my age, I think I need a nice long lie down after all of that.
Well, before we talk about the game itself then, maybe this is a good time to look at the mess that has been South American qualifying with COVID-19 and games having to be postponed. What's already a pretty hectic schedule for qualifying, a Copa America sandwich in the middle of that. It seems perfectly understandable that the South American teams don't have a huge appetite for Arsene Wenger's idea of a World Cup every 2 years when you look at the amount of qualifying which is required in South America for the current model.
Yeah, and if that model were to change, qualification would have to change. And that's the reason why South America is dead set against this idea of a World Cup every 2 years. In fact, South America has said that it will not participate. When initially the idea was floated, there was some interest, and then CONMEBOL, South America's confederation, consulted the membership, and they saw that the countries were very much against. Because really what Arsene Wenger's plan is, and I think it's very Eurocentric in this sense, it's a war on World Cup qualification. You will, in order to have the World Cup every 2 years, the qualification campaign must be shortened, reduced to a minimum. And South America, since 1996 for the France 98 qualifiers, has had this one big group format with all the countries playing each other home and away. It takes a long time, but there's no doubt about it. It's the most competitive World Cup qualification campaign on the planet, and it's led to a dramatic improvement in the standards of the lesser nations or the smaller nations. So I'll run you through it. Ecuador had never qualified for the World Cup until 2002. 2006, they got through to the second round and gave England a game. 2010, best World Cup in the history of Paraguay. 2014, best World Cup in the history of Colombia. 10 and 14 were the best in the history of Chile, with the exception of 62, which they hosted. And Uruguay have come back to the top table, semi-finalists in 2010, best South American side statistically in two of the last three World Cups. 25 years ago, all of that was seen as unthinkable. So South America came to the conclusion that if qualification is shortened, it's got a lot more to lose than to gain from Arsene Wenger's plan.
And a lot will be lost as well, Tim, if you consider that pretty much all of the stars of the countries you've just named play their football in Europe. So therefore, if you're a fan of Argentina or Uruguay or Ecuador or Brazil, chances are the only time that you get to see your star player in the flesh is in a World Cup qualifier, or if your country is hosting the Copa America.
Will, you have hit the nail on the proverbial. And this is why I think Arsene's idea is so Eurocentric. I understand his desire to preserve players from the amount of travelling that they have to do. But, you know, for crowds in not only South America, but Africa, Asia, this is the time. It's the only time that you get to see the players that your continent produces. And European audiences are spoiled. They can watch these players every week. The global audiences can't. And that, I think, is another convincing idea against Monsieur Wenger's plan.
We had, again, a very tightly fought game between Argentina and Brazil this week. What World Cup qualification on the line for Argentina? They're now 27 games unbeaten, yep. A stretch that goes right back through the Copa America, which they won on Brazilian soil during this summer. Ahead of 2022, how good or bad are Argentina now looking?
Well, they're looking more like a team than they've done for a long, long time. It was a caretaker coach, Lionel Scaloni, who took over after the shambles of the last World Cup. He obviously spent time finding his feet. But in the Copa America of 2019, that they started disastrously, you could see him beginning to build towards something more coherent, beginning to house Lionel Messi in a collective structure that gets the best out of him. And that they haven't lost since the semi-final of that 2019 Copa against Brazil. So one of the things that came in first was the midfield. And the best thing about this unbeaten run has been their fluidity in the midfield. Rodrigo De Paul, terrific player, wonderful range of passing. Giovanni Lo Celso, much more effective for Argentina than he's been for Tottenham. And he has a sweet thing going with Messi. And Argentina are moving the ball so well. And it means that they're bringing Messi into the game in pockets of the field where he can do some damage. Whereas before, plan A was give the ball to Messi and pray, and plan B was also give the ball to Messi and pray. Now they're beginning to get the best out of him. And I think he's more motivated to play for Argentina than he is for Paris Saint-Germain. But the key part of the jigsaw since June has been the emergence of a goalkeeper and a centre-back, because defence has been a weak part of the Argentina team for a while. It's been a long time since they produced a top-class goalkeeper. Emiliano Martinez of Aston Villa made his debut in June. Christian Romero made his debut in June. And Martinez is quite clearly the best keeper they've had in a long time. And Romero looks like the best centre-back they've had in a long time. And so they're not conceding. Since the Copa America, and they came out of the Copa America full of confidence, since the Copa America, in the seven rounds of World Cup qualification that they've played, they've conceded one goal. And that was a ludicrous VAR penalty away to Venezuela when the game was already won. So they've tightened up there defensively. Yes, there are times when they look to be defending absolutely at the limit. They've needed heroics from Martinez. And it was clear on Tuesday night against Brazil that they were worried by the pace of the Brazilian attack. And I think that's one explanation for that one that Nico Otamendi got away with, the forearm smash into the face of Leeds winger Rafinha. The referees, the VAR referees, the officials have all been suspended subsequently for not spotting that one and sending off Otamendi. So there are times when they've been defending at the limit. And this perhaps is a difference from Brazil, who don't look like conceding goals. But even at the limit, Argentina are keeping their opponents at bay, keeping clean sheets. As a team, it's been a long, long time since I've been this coherent and this confident.
Is Otamendi hated in Brazil, Tim, given in the Copa America this year his cynical fouling and then that elbow on Rafinha during the week as well? He seems to be a guy who let's just say, plays on the line when he plays against Brazil.
Yes, he played here for a while, so that there'll be some who have happy memories of him. But I think the story of Otamendi, I remember him coming through the ranks. 2008, you thought that he might be the solution. I think we saw when he stepped into the highest level. I well remember the game at home to Brazil in 2009, when you could see he wasn't quite as good as maybe he'd been led to expect. And I think he's tried to compensate with some strong arm stuff. It was from the point of view of a cynical elbow, it was beautifully done, because I don't blame the referee for not spotting the intention there. I don't blame the referee. It was done very, very quickly. The VAR officials, I think, should have done better. But that is an area of the team where I still think Argentina need to improve. Romero has come in once as a right-sided centre-back. There are one or two that maybe they could have a look at for the left-sided centre-back, especially Facundo Medina, who looks like a strong player, could be bound for the Premier League. I think there is still room for improvement in that position with the Argentina team. And yes, certainly after Tuesday night's game, Otamendi has become a symbol in Brazil of strong arm tactics from Argentina.
Within the Premier League this year, there's been plenty of criticism, Roy Keane particularly, of Fred playing for Manchester United and some of his pretty indifferent performances that he's had so far this year. But he was man of the match, high energy for Brazil against Argentina. How is Fred viewed back home compared to maybe some Manchester United fans who get frustrated with his play?
Well, he's not a glamour player, and partly because he didn't play for one of the big clubs in Rio or São Paulo. He played for Internacional in the south of Brazil, so that robs him a little bit of a constituency. And then he was in Eastern Europe before the move to Manchester United. So he's not a glamour player, and there are discussions in Brazil. You know, can't we get anyone better to fill this position? But his performances this month and last month as well, when they beat Uruguay 4-1, he was excellent. I think they mean that now it's hard to imagine him being replaced in the short term. He's never going to be a glamorous player. He's in the team, and when he was called up not long ago, Brazil, the coaching staff, they made a point of pointing to his stats, especially the distance that he covers during games and the distance that he covers at pace. And he's playing alongside, usually it's Casemiro. On Tuesday, with Casemiro suspended, it was Fabinho of Liverpool. Now, these aren't the most mobile of players. And the formation that Brazil are using, and they used on Tuesday, they played two wingers, plus an out-and-out centre-forward and Lucas Paquetá just off him. So there was a lot of ground to cover. And Fred really showed terrific dynamism to cover that ground, to stop Messi getting the ball in interesting areas of space. And there is some dynamism with the ball as well, because he'll keep things simple, lay it off first time, and he nearly scored with his right foot against Argentina. As I say, he made the vital first goal for Brazil against Uruguay last month. So I think we're seeing enough of him in a Brazil shirt to conclude that he is not Manchester United's problem. He may not be the solution, but Manchester United's problems are far bigger than one midfielder, maybe he's being scapegoated for problems in the overall running of the club.
Well, football here on Off the Ball is with thanks to Sky. You can watch Liverpool and Arsenal go head-to-head Saturday Night Football, which is live only on Sky Sports. Dani Alves might be a player still going to Qatar, Tim, with this Brazil team. I was watching his press conference yesterday. Returns to Barcelona, 5 years after leaving the club. Says he was so determined to get back at some point, despite his jaunt around Europe and then briefly going back to Brazil. He's 38 years of age. He played that down multiple times in his press conference when he had some of the best glasses I've ever seen during that press conference too. Mm-hmm. But he seems determined. He's in good physical fitness. He thinks, even though he can't play till January, if he is a good 5 months with Barcelona, he thinks he could still go to the World Cup with Brazil.
No doubt about it. And he was the first choice right back until he started picking up some injury problems. And when they won that Copa America in 2019, he was chosen as the player of the tournament. And he recently won the Olympic gold medal. So he's still very, very much in the fold. This has quite a lot to do with the way that Brazil are now playing. With open wingers, especially on the right. Rafinha of Leeds has come in recently and he's already made that position his own. So what they don't need is the fullback as an auxiliary winger. bombing up and down the field, a role that at the age of 38, Daniel Alves simply couldn't do now at this stage in his career. The line that I've heard the coach, Chichi, use is he wants more Manchester City fullbacks than Liverpool fullbacks. So what he's looking for from his right back, and it's not Brazil's strongest position. The first choice at the moment is Danilo, once of Man City, now at Juventus. Second choice is Emerson Royal of Tottenham, who is still raw, especially defensively. He's much more of that auxiliary winger type figure. So what Brazil are looking for from the right back is someone who can construct from deep and also fill in to midfield to make the extra man to stop Fred and Casemiro or Fred and Fabinho from being outnumbered. So it's a less physically taxing role. And it's the one hole in the career of Daniel Alves. You know, he's won all of those trophies, but the World Cup has been cruel to him. So the thing that is still keeping him going is the dream of playing in the World Cup this time next year and rounding off his career there. And I think it's an achievable dream.
You mentioned Rafinha, who plays just ahead of him and has been a star turn for Leeds over the last season and a bit. He's been linked, understandably, with a lot of the top teams in England, potentially moving from Leeds to Liverpool have been linked with him, and plenty of the other top European teams. It's probably going to take quite a chunk of change to allow him to leave Elland Road. But it's perfectly understandable why teams are looking at him. He's a remarkably good player.
Well, you know, when he made his Brazil debut off the bench last month, away to Venezuela, and I tell you, when he came on, the vast majority of Brazil's football public didn't really know who he was. He didn't really play here. He made his career abroad. Leeds, not one of the Premier League giants who are followed so assiduously. And Brazil at the time were losing to Venezuela. And they trailed in that game for over an hour. He won that game. It was a remarkable display. I mean, first with his set pieces, and then with his ball skills and his pace and his good decision making, he won that game. His first start was Brazil's best performance for years when they beat Uruguay 4-1 and instantly clicked with Neymar. So in the course of just a few days, he went from being a virtual unknown to Brazil's football public to becoming a new national hero. And the coach, Chichi, was playing it down a little bit, saying, no, he's a young player. He's not going to play at this level all the time. He's going to oscillate a little bit. But this is a new national hero for the country, and hugely exciting what he's been doing for the national team.
Is anyone surprised about Philippe Coutinho's complete fall from grace? Like, he made the trip, I think it's 4,000 kilometres in air miles he picked up, didn't get off the bench in the first two games of this window for Brazil. He, even at club level, despite Barcelona's issues, he's fallen totally out of favour. Like, this is a player who left for a huge fee only just a few years ago to leave from Liverpool, where he was so instrumental, that Philippe Coutinho has really, really dropped off the radar now.
Yeah, it was a bad move to Barcelona. Although, if you're a Brazilian creative attacking player, how can you say no when Barcelona come knocking? But it was a terrible move. It's to me, it's indicative of the incompetence of the club and the shambles that they've got themselves into. Because the original idea was that he was going to be an Iniesta replacement, and he's not a midfielder. He's a player for the final third of the field. So that was never going to work. And then, if you remember, they tried to play him in the front three, which is his more natural position, but they had Messi and Suarez, both aging, and they needed a flyer. They needed someone who wanted the ball ahead of them to stretch the defence and open up space. Felipe Coutinho is yet another player who wants the ball to his feet. So the Barcelona paid a fortune for a player that they didn't need and couldn't really use. Now, if you look at Coutinho's career, in a way, Liverpool is an exception. I think he's quite a shy young man. And you can see that a number of times in his career, when he's taken a step up, it's been difficult for him. He didn't do well for Brazil at under 17 level. Under 20 level, he was a bit part player. Inter Milan, well, in the end, they'd had a long-term relationship with him, but they ended up practically giving him away for nothing to Liverpool, where he flowered. Now, he had flowered a little bit on loan before at Espanyol under Pochettino. And I think this is interesting. I think as perhaps a quite quiet, introverted figure, The Pochettino full-on love approach was exactly what he needed. And I think he got the same tender, loving care at Liverpool. Barcelona, which is a bigger thing altogether, and you know, walking into that dressing room, I think was very hard for him. And I think the reason that he was called up by Brazil now, it was a surprise call up. If I can remind you that initially, before Roberto Firmino of Liverpool pulled out, Vinicius Junior wasn't in the squad, and Felipe Coutinho was. That seemed very strange given their club form. Mm. I think the reason that the coach called him up was not necessarily that he was going to use him at this point, but just to keep him in the fold, just to give him a little bit of affection. He's lost his international place to Lucas Paquetá of Lyon, who's in terrific form and has a sweet thing going with Neymar. So he's gonna really have to work to get back in the squad, to get back in the team. But the coach has a lot of time for him and a lot of affection for him. I think the coach thinks that with a little bit of affection, he can help Felipe Coutinho along the way. And I wonder if he could turn the clock back if Coutinho would say no to Barcelona. But as I say, if you're an attacking Brazilian player and you get the chance to put yourself in that tradition of Romario, Ronaldinho and Rivaldo and so on, how on earth do you say no? So Coutinho maybe now wishes that he had said no, but too late to turn the clock back on that one.
And Tim, I don't intend to end this on a down note, but Sergio Kun Aguero, since we would have chatted to you last, a decision has to be made on his footballing future really in the new year. I think he's saying around February or March he's likely to get more information from specialists. But after the cardiac incident that he had playing for Barcelona last month, it seems at this stage there's a very real decision to be made as to whether Sergio Aguero will play professional football again.
Yes, and if he does have to leave, well, it's a blow for him. It's a huge blow for Independiente back in Argentina, the club who sold him to Europe and have been dreaming of getting him back ever since. And that was the plan for the end of this European contract, for him to move back and play for Independiente. And they more or less rebuilt their stadium on the proceeds of his sale, and they were ready to roll out the red carpet to welcome him back to play in the stadium that he helped to build. Obviously, there are doubts about that. But if he does have to leave the game, what a legacy he's left. The one thing missing from it is title with Argentina. He's more success with Argentina. He's the third top goal scorer of all time in Argentina, with some magnificent players behind him. But the big tournaments always seem to come, you know, at the end of the season when he was not firing on all cylinders. And he, I think, a little bit like his new clubmate Daniel Alves, he was looking towards the next World Cup as maybe the big chance to sign off his international career with something a little bit special. But that now looks unlikely.
Well, look, fingers crossed he gets the all clear and he can get back playing again. Tim, thanks a million for joining us on Off the Ball.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-all-fits branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code pod20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20, code pod20, for 20% off your first product.